Reflections on the Revolution in France by Edmund Burke, first published in 1790. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Second one-third of Part 2. Old Nobility versus New Money. The National Assembly's attitude to the paying of state debts varied between extreme rigour and extreme laxity, the difference depending not on the nature of the debt, but on the situation of the creditor. The acts of the old government of the kings of France are all, except for its monetary arrangements, held by the National Assembly to be invalid, indeed to be so odious that pensions given as a reward for service to the state are criminally tainted. We have seen multitudes of pensioners in France, who had never been deprived of their allowances by the most arbitrary ministers in the most arbitrary times, robbed without mercy by this assembly of the rights of men. They were told that their services had not been rendered to the country that now exists. To some of the old government's other debts, the assembly has a different attitude. There is no justification for this difference, but it does have a cause, which isn't hard to discover. Through the vast debt of France, a great moneyed interest had gradually grown up, and with it a great power. In that kingdom the general circulation of property, and in particular the convertibility of land into money and vice versa, had always been difficult because of certain features of French law. This kept the landed and moneyed interests more separated in France, and kept the owners of the two kinds of property less well disposed to each other than they are in England. The moneyed property was long looked on unfavourably by the people who saw it as making their distresses worse, and it was envied by the old landed interests, mainly because its ostentatious display of splendid luxury eclipsed the pedigrees and titles of many nobles who had nothing but their status as nobility. The nobility that represented the more permanent landed interest sometimes united themselves by marriage with the other kind, but the wealth that saved a noble family from ruin was thought to contaminate and degrade it. In the meantime, the wealthy men who were not noble or were newly noble resented the way the others looked down on them. They were willing to do anything to get revenge for the outrages of this rival pride, and to exalt their wealth to what they regarded as its natural rank and esteem. They struck at the nobility through the crown and the church, especially through the possessions of the church, which through the patronage of the crown generally came to the nobility. In this state of sometimes hidden warfare between the noble ancient landed interest and the new moneyed interest, the latter was stronger because its power was easier to deploy. Political men of letters. Along with the moneyed interest, a new kind of men had grown up, with whom the moneyed interest soon formed a close and marked union. I mean the political men of letters. Men of letters like to stand out, so they are rarely averse to innovation. Since the decline of the life and greatness of Louis XIV, they were not so much cultivated by him, or the regent, or the successors to the crown, and not bound to the court by favours and emoluments as systematically as they were during the splendid period of that ostentatious and not impolitic reign. What they lost in the old court protection they tried to make up by joining in a sort of corporation of their own, to which the two academies of France, and afterwards the vast undertaking of the Encyclopaedia, carried on by a society of these gentlemen, contributed considerably. Some years ago, the literary cabal had formed something like a regular plan for the destruction of the Christian religion. They pursued this objective with a degree of zeal that until then had been exhibited only by the propagators of some system of piety. They had a fanatical spirit of proselytism, from which they easily slid into a spirit of persecution. With great skill and perseverance, they got hold of all the avenues to literary fame. Many of them, indeed, stood high in the ranks of literature and science. the world had done them justice, and because of their general talents, it forgave the evil tendency of their special principles. This was true liberality, which they repaid by trying to confine the reputation for sense, learning, and taste to themselves or their followers. This exclusive spirit has been just as harmful to literature and taste as to morals and true philosophy. These atheistic fathers have a bigotry of their own, and they have learned to talk against monks with the spirit of a monk. But in some things they are men of the world. The resources of intrigue are called in to make up for the defects of argument and wit. This system of literary monopoly was combined with unremitting efforts to blacken and discredit anyone who did not belong to their faction. It has been clear for years that all they lacked was the power to move from the intolerance of the tongue and pen to a persecution that would strike at property, liberty, and life. The casual and faint persecution carried on against them, more from compliance with form and decency than from resentment, did not weaken their strength or relax their efforts. The outcome of the whole situation, including opposition and success, was that a violent and malignant zeal of a previously unknown kind took complete possession of their minds and made their whole conversation, which otherwise would have been pleasing and instructive, perfectly disgusting. They began to insinuate themselves into a correspondence with foreign princes, hoping that they might, through the prince's authority, which at first they flattered, bring about the changes they had in view. They didn't care whether these changes were to be accomplished by the thunderbolt of despotism or the earthquake of popular commotion. For that same purpose they also cultivated the moneyed interest of France, and with their help they carefully occupied all the avenues to opinion. When writers act in a body and with one direction, they have great influence on the public mind. So the alliance of these writers with the moneyed interest had a big effect in removing the popular dislike and envy evoked by that sort of wealth. These writers, like all propagators of novelties, claimed to have a great zeal for the poor and the lower orders, while in their satires they used every exaggeration to make horrible the faults of courts, of nobility, and of priesthood. They became a sort of demagogues. They served as a link to unite obnoxious wealth with restless and desperate poverty, all in the service of one objective. As these two kinds of men, the newly wealthy and the writers, appear to be principal leaders in all the recent doings, their combination and politics will serve to explain the general fury with which all the landed property of ecclesiastical corporations has been attacked, and the great care which, contrary to their pretended principles, has been taken of a moneyed interest originating from the authority of the crown. All the envy against wealth and power was skilfully directed against other kinds of riches. How else can we account for an appearance so extraordinary and unnatural as that of the ecclesiastical possessions, which had survived so many successions of ages and shocks of civil violence, and were protected at once by justice and by prejudice, being applied to the payment of comparatively recent debts contracted by a decried and subverted government? Confiscation. Was the public estate a sufficient stake for the public debts? Assume that it was not, and that a loss must be incurred somewhere. When the only estate lawfully possessed, the only one the contracting parties had in mind when their bargain was made, happens to fail, who ought to suffer the loss? It should be suffered by those who are weak enough to lend on bad security, or those who fraudulently held out a security that was not valid. But according to the new Institute of the Rights of Men, the only persons who ought to suffer the loss are precisely those who should be protected from it. The debt is to be paid by those who were neither lenders nor borrowers. If any persons are to make good deficiencies to the public creditor, other than the public at large, they must be those who manage the agreement. So why aren't the estates of all the comptrollers general confiscated? Why not those of the long succession of ministers, financiers, and bankers, who have been enriched while the nation was impoverished by their dealings and their advice? Few barbarous conquerors have ever made so terrible a revolution in property. None of the heads of the Roman factions, when they auctioned off things they had acquired by violence, ever offered for sale such an enormous amount of the goods of the conquered citizen. It must be allowed in favour of those tyrants of antiquity that they can hardly be said to have acted in cold blood. Their passions were inflamed, their tempers soured, their understandings confused with the spirit of revenge. They were driven beyond all bounds of moderation, by fear of the return of power, with the return of property, to the families of those they had injured beyond all hope of forgiveness. But those Roman confiscators, who were only at the early stages of tyranny, and were not instructed in the rights of men, to practice all sorts of cruelties on each other, without provocation, thought it necessary to spread a sort of colour over their injustice. They considered the vanquished party as composed of traitors who had acted with hostility towards the Commonwealth and had forfeited their property by their crimes. With you in contemporary France, in your supposedly improved state of the human mind, there was no such formality. You seized £5 million of sterling of annual rent and turned more than 40,000 human creatures out of their houses because such was your pleasure. The tyrant Henry VIII of England, not having studied in your new schools, did not know what an effectual instrument of despotism was to be found in that grand magazine of offensive weapons, the Rights of Men. When he decided to rob the abbeys, as your club of the Jacobins have robbed all the ecclesiastics, he went through elaborate procedures to create a false justification for his iniquitous proceedings. Had fate reserved him to our times, 4 technical terms would have done his business. All he needed was 1 short form of incantation: philosophy, light, liberality, the rights of men. I can say nothing in praise of acts of tyranny that no one voice has ever commended under any of their false colours, but in these false colours homage was paid by despotism to justice. The power that was above all fear and all remorse was not set above all shame. While shame keeps its watch, virtue is not wholly extinguished in the heart, and moderation will not be utterly exiled from the minds of tyrants. I believe every honest man sympathizes in his reflections with our political poet, Sir John Denham, who writes, "What crimes could any Christian king incense to such a rage? Was it luxury or lust? Was he so temperate, so chaste, so just? Were these their crimes? They were his own much more, but wealth is crime enough to him that's poor." This same wealth was your temptation to violate property, law, and religion, united in one object. But was the state of France so wretched and undone that nothing but theft could preserve its existence? Tell me, when the states met, was the condition of the finances of France such that, after economizing on principles of justice and mercy through all regions, no fair sharing of burdens could possibly restore them? If such an equal imposition would have been sufficient, you know very well that it could easily have been made. Monsieur Necker, in the budget he laid before the National Assembly, gave a detailed exposition of the state of the French nation. According to him, it was not necessary to resort to any new impositions to put France's receipts in balance with its expenses. He concludes with these emphatic words: "What a country this is, gentlemen, that can wipe out a deficit that has made such a noise in Europe, without compulsory fees and with simple procedures that no one will notice." Like you, I have a high degree of respect for Monsieur Necker, and I have no doubt that what he said was exact, So what can be said in favour of those who, instead of moderate, reasonable, and general contribution, have, in cold blood and with no necessity to do so, resorted to a partial and cruel confiscation? As for the clergy, they offered an extravagant contribution that obviously would have done more to pay off the public debt than anything that could be reasonably expected from the confiscation. Why was this offer not accepted? The reason is plain. There was no desire for the church to serve the state. The service of the state was made a pretext to destroy the church. They had no scruples about destroying the church by means that would also destroy their country, and they have destroyed it. The effects of confiscation. The madness of the initial plan for confiscation soon became apparent, bringing into the market all at once this unwieldy mass of landed property would obviously defeat the purpose of the confiscation, because it would lower the value of those lands. Another drawback was the sudden diversion of all the country's circulating money from trade to land. What step was taken? Did the Assembly, on becoming aware of the inevitable ill effects of their projected sale, decide to accept the offer of the clergy? No. After trying something different that didn't work, they returned to the idea of sale, but with a difference. Instead of paying the old debt, they contracted a new debt at 3%, creating a new paper currency based on an eventual sale of the church lands. The spoil of the church had now become the only resource of all their operations in finance, the vital principle of all their politics, the sole security for the existence of their power. It was necessary by any means, even the most violent, to put every individual on the same footing, and to bind the nation in one guilty interest to uphold this act, and the authority of those by whom it was done. In order to force the most reluctant into sharing in their pillage, they made their paper money compulsory in all payments. To cut off all appearance of connection between the Crown and public justice, and to bring the whole under complete obedience to the dictators in Paris, the old independent judicature of the regional appeal courts, with all its merits and all its faults, was wholly abolished. While those courts existed, the people might sometimes resort to them and rally under the standard of their ancient laws. But thought had to be given to the fact that the magistrates and officers in the courts now abolished had purchased their places at a very high price, for which, as well as for the duty they performed, they received only a very low rate of return. These lawyers are to receive compensation, adding up to an immense amount. This becomes part of the national debt, for the liquidation of which there is the one inexhaustible fund. The dismissed magistrates are to get their compensation in the new church paper money, receiving their own property in a manner that must be looked on with horror by all those who have grown up with the ancient principles of jurisprudence and been the sworn guardians of property. And the clergy must either starve or receive their miserable allowance out of paper money, stamped with the indelible character of sacrilege and with the symbols of their own ruin. The alliance of bankruptcy and tyranny has seldom committed an outrage against credit, property, and liberty as violent as this compulsory paper currency. It eventually comes to light that in reality the lands of the church are not to be sold at all. By the recent resolutions of the National Assembly, they are indeed to be delivered to the highest bidder. But notice that only a certain portion of the purchase money is to be laid down, with a period of 12 years allowed for the payment of the rest. The philosophic purchasers are therefore on payment of a sort of fine, to be put instantly into possession of the estate. It becomes in some respects a sort of gift to them, to be held on condition of zeal to the new establishment. This project is evidently to let in a body of purchasers without money. The consequence would be that after 12 years these purchasers, or rather grant recipients, will pay the remainder of the purchase price from the rents as they accrue, the spoil of the materials of buildings, waste in woods, and whatever money they can wring from the miserable peasant. The peasant is to be delivered over to the mercenary and arbitrary discretion of men who will be stimulated to every sort of extortion by the growing demands on their growing profits. When all the frauds, impostures, thefts, burnings, murders, confiscations, compulsory paper currencies, and every kind of tyranny and cruelty employed to create and uphold this revolution have shocked the moral sentiments of all virtuous and sober minds, the abettors of this philosophic system declaim against the old monarchical government of France, and imply that those who disapprove of their new abuses must be partisans of the old. Their needs do indeed compel them to this base and contemptible fraud. Nothing can reconcile men to their proceedings but the supposition that there is no third option between them and some utterly odious tyranny. This prattling of theirs does not rise to the level of sophistry. It is nothing but plain impudence. Have these gentlemen never heard of anything between the despotism of the monarch and the despotism of the multitude? Have they never heard of a monarchy directed by laws, controlled and balanced by the great hereditary wealth and hereditary dignity of a nation, and both again controlled by a judicious check from the reason and feeling of the people at large, acting by a suitable and permanent organ such as the English House of Commons? A pure democracy is the only tolerable form into which human society can be thrown. Is that a truth so universally acknowledged that a man is not permitted to hesitate about its merits without the suspicion of being a friend to tyranny, a foe to mankind? What is wrong with absolute democracy? I do not know how to classify the present ruling authority in France. It purports to be a pure democracy, though I think it is heading towards soon being a wicked oligarchy. But for the present, I admit it to be a contrivance with the nature and effect that it claims to have. I don't reject any form of government merely on abstract principles. There may be situations in which the purely democratic form will become necessary. There may be some, very few, and in very special circumstances, where it would be clearly desirable. But until now, we have seen no examples of large democracies. The ancients were better acquainted with them, and the authors who had seen the most of those constitutions, and who best understood them, held that an absolute democracy is no more to be reckoned among the legitimate forms of government than absolute monarchy. They thought it to be the corruption and degeneracy of a republic rather than a sound constitution. In a democracy, whenever strong divisions prevail, as they often must in that kind of system, the majority of the citizens is capable of oppressing the minority in far greater numbers and with much greater fury than can almost ever be feared from a monarchy. Individual sufferers are in a much more deplorable condition in such a persecution by the people than in any other persecution. Under a cruel prince, they have the soothing compassion of mankind to lessen the sting of their wounds. They have the plaudits of the people to strengthen their good-hearted constancy under their sufferings. But those who are wronged by multitudes are deprived of all external consolation. They seem deserted by mankind, overpowered by a conspiracy of their whole species. The faults of the French monarchy. But suppose that I am wrong, and democracy does not have an inevitable tendency to tyranny, and suppose it to have as much good in it when absolute as I am sure it has when compounded with other forms. Does monarchy contain nothing to recommend it? Bolingbroke has one observation, which I think has some depth and solidity. He says that he prefers a monarchy to other governments because you can better graft any kind of republic onto a monarchy than graft anything of monarchy onto the republican forms. I think he is perfectly right. The fact is so, historically, and it agrees well with political theory. I know how easy it is to dwell on the faults of departed greatness, but we should judge human institutions as we do human characters, sorting out the good from the evil that is mixed in mortal institutions as it is in mortal men. Your government in France was usually, and I think justly, reputed to be the best of the absolute or nearly absolute monarchies, but it was still full of abuses. These accumulated over time, as they must in every monarchy that is not under the constant inspection of a popular representative. I am no stranger to the faults and defects of the now subverted government of France, and I am not inclined by nature or policy to sing the praises of anything that is a natural object of just censure. But our present question concerns not the vices of that monarchy, but its existence. So, was the French government so incapable or so undeserving of reform that it was absolutely necessary that the whole structure should be at once pulled down and the area cleared for the erection of a theoretical experimental edifice in its place? At the beginning of 1789, all France was of a different opinion. The instructions to the representatives to the States General from every district in that kingdom were filled with projects for reforming that government, without the remotest suggestion of a plan to destroy it. Had such a plan been even hinted at, I believe there would have been only one voice, a voice for rejecting it with scorn and horror. When those instructions from the districts were given, there was no doubt that abuses existed, and that they demanded reform. Between then and the revolution, things changed their shape. Who, then, was in the right? Those who would have reformed, or those who have destroyed? To hear some men speak of the late monarchy of France, you would imagine that they were talking of the barbarous anarchic despotism of Turkey, where the finest countries in the world's friendliest climates are more wasted by peace than any countries have been worried by war, where arts are unknown, where manufactures languish, where science is extinguished, where agriculture decays, where the human race itself melts away. Was this the case of France? The facts answer no. Along with much evil, there is some good in monarchy itself, and some correctives to its evil from religion, from laws, from manners, from opinions that the French monarchy must have received. These correctives made it, though not a free constitution and thus not a good one, a despotism in appearance rather than in reality. National wealth. The wealth of a country is a standard by which we may judge whether a government is, on the whole, protecting or destructive. France far exceeds England in the size of its population, but her comparative wealth is much inferior to ours, and not as evenly distributed or as freely circulating. The difference in the form of the two governments is, I think, one cause of this advantage on the side of England. But wealth that is incomparably less than England's may still constitute a very respectable degree of affluence. Monsieur Necker's book on Financial Administration in France, published in 1785, presents accurate and interesting facts concerning public economy and political arithmetic, and his thoughts about this are generally wise and liberal. In that work, he does not depict France as a country whose government was a perfect grievance, an absolute evil, curable only by the violent and uncertain remedy of a total revolution. He affirms that between 1726 and 1784, the French mint coined gold and silver to the amount of about £100 million, this being a matter of official record, and therefore quite certain. His reasonings about the quantity of gold and silver still in circulation when he wrote in 1785, 4 years before the deposition of the French king, are not equally certain, but his grounds for them seem so solid that it is hard not to accept his conclusions. He calculates the coin money then actually existing in France at about £88 million, a great accumulation of wealth for one country, even a large one. Monsieur Necker also wrote in 1785 that he expected a future annual increase of 2% on the money brought into France during the period from which he computed. Some cause must have originally introduced all the money coined at its mint into that kingdom, and some equally operative cause must have kept at home, or returned to its bosom, such a vast treasure as Monsieur Necker calculates to remain for domestic circulation. Causes with that much power to acquire and to retain cannot be found in discouraged industry, insecure property, and a positively destructive government. Indeed, when I consider the number and affluence of France's cities, her spacious high roads and bridges, her artificial canals, opening the conveniences of maritime communication through such an immense solid continent, when I look at the stupendous works of her ports and harbours, and to her whole naval apparatus, whether for war or trade, when I survey the number of her fortifications, designed with such bold and masterly skill, and built and maintained at such a prodigious expense, presenting an armed front and impenetrable barrier to her enemies on every side. When I recollect how small a part of France's extensive region is uncultivated, and to what complete perfection the culture of many of the best productions of the earth have been brought there, when I reflect on the excellence of her manufactures and fabrics, second to none but ours, and in some respects not second to ours, when I contemplate the grand foundations of charity, public and private, when I survey the state of all the arts that beautify and polish life, when I take account of the men France has bred for extending her fame in war, her able statesmen, the multitude of her profound lawyers and theologians, her philosophers, her critics, her historians and antiquaries, her poets and her orators, sacred and profane. I behold in all this something that awes the imagination, stops the mind from rushing into indiscriminate censure, and requires us to examine seriously what are the latent vices that could authorize us at once to pull such a vast structure to the ground. I do not recognize in this view of things the character of a government that has been so oppressive, corrupt, or negligent as to be utterly unfit for all reformation. I must think such a government well deserved to have its excellence heightened, its faults corrected, and its capacities improved into a British constitution. Anyone who examines the proceedings of that deposed government for several years back cannot fail to observe, amidst the inconstancy and fluctuation natural to royal courts, an earnest endeavour toward the prosperity and improvement of the country. He must admit that this endeavour had long been directed, in some instances, wholly to remove, in many instances considerably to correct, the abusive practices and usages that had prevailed in the state, and that even the unlimited power of the sovereign over the persons of his subjects, inconsistent as it undoubtedly was with law and liberty, had been exercised more and more lightly. So far from refusing to reform, that government was all too easily open to all sorts of projects. Rather too much of a hearing was given to the spirit of innovation, which was soon turned against those who had fostered it, and were then ruined by it. To compare the government of France for the last 15 years with wise and well-constituted establishments during that period is not fair. But if we compare it with any of the former reigns in France, in respect of extravagance with money, or strictness in the exercise of power, we won't believe in the good intentions of those who dwell perpetually on the donations to favourites, or on the expenses of the court, or on the horrors of the Bastille, in the reign of Louis XVI. I doubt that the system, if it deserves to be called a system, now built on the ruins of that former monarchy, will be able to give a better account of the wealth of the country it has taken under its care. Instead of improving by the change, it will need many years to recover from the effects of this philosophic revolution, so that the nation is replaced on its former footing. I hear that there are considerable emigrations from France, and that many people, leaving that voluptuous climate and that seductive liberty, have taken refuge in Canada, in frozen territory, under British despotism. With the present disappearance of coin, no one could think France the same country as the one in which the present Minister of the Finances was able to find £80 million in coinage. Already the population of Paris has so declined that Monsieur Necker told the National Assembly that the provision needed for its subsistence is 20% less than what was formerly required. It is said, and I have never heard it contradicted, that 100,000 people are unemployed in that city, although it has become the seat of the imprisoned court and National Assembly. Nothing, I am credibly informed, can exceed the shocking and disgusting spectacle of begging displayed in that capital. Indeed, the National Assembly has recently appointed a standing committee to deal with begging. They are contriving at once a vigorous policy on this subject, and, for the first time, the imposition of a tax to maintain the poor, for whose present relief great sums appear in the public accounts of the year. In the meantime, the leaders of the legislative clubs and coffee-houses are intoxicated with admiration at their own wisdom and ability. To comfort the people in the rags they have clothed them in, they tell them that they are a nation of philosophers, and by various devices they try to drown the cries of poverty and to divert the eyes of the observer from the ruin and wretchedness of the state. A brave people will certainly prefer liberty, accompanied by virtuous poverty, to depraved and wealthy servitude. But before the price of comfort and affluence is paid, one ought to be pretty sure that what one is buying is real liberty, and that it is to be purchased at no other price. End of the second one-third of part 2.